This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. A nation must secure its borders and properly enforce immigration laws. Doing this requires resources, dedication, and a strategic focus. It also involves a commitment to homeland security and public safety through the enforcement of federal criminal and civil laws governing border control, customs, trade, and immigration. The United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is charged with such a mission, and it's no small feat. One fraught with difficult, complex, and seemingly intractable issues, faced at a time when the reality of finite resources continues to press federal agencies such as ICE to manage its priorities more strategically. What is ICE's strategic vision? How is ICE pursuing innovative enforcement strategies? And what is ICE doing to be more efficient and effective in meeting its mission? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, John Morton, Director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. John, welcome to the show. It's great to have you back.
Great to be back again.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. George, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, John, before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you could give us a brief overview of the history and a continually evolving mission of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. When was it created and what's its mission to date?
So ICE was created in 2003 after the terrible events of September 11th, and it was a merger of two proud agencies that have been around for quite some time, the United States Customs Service and the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And when Congress put the two agencies together, it at once created the largest investigative component within the Department of Homeland Security and essentially the interior enforcement powers of the old Immigration and Naturalization Service and put it all into one agency. We have about 20,000 employees, a budget of $5.8 billion, and we're about to approach our first 10 years as an agency here in about a year. So things are coming along.
So you mentioned the size of your budget, the number of FTEs. Could you tell us a little bit more about how your agency is organized?
So we have two primary functions. One is to investigate violations of criminal law having to do with homeland security, read borders, transportation, immigration, customs. And the other is to enforce the nation's immigration laws from an administrative perspective in coordination with our partners at Customs and Border Protection. So the people that you see at the airport, the immigration inspectors, the customs inspectors, work for Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, our sister agency. They are the line inspection function. We are the enforcement apparatus in the interior and in support of CBP along the border. When it comes to the criminal investigative function, we have a very, very broad jurisdiction, much broader than most people realize, and we're quite large. In fact, we're the second largest criminal investigative agency in the entire United States, behind only the FBI. And so we're the principal investigative arm of the Department of Homeland Security and investigate a wide range of crimes all the way from child pornography, child exploitation, human trafficking to drug dealing and the theft of art overseas that is smuggled into the United States.
You have a geographical footprint that's global, correct?
That's right. So we're in every state of the union and in 49 countries overseas.
John, I'd like to transition a little bit from this complex agency to talk a little bit about you. and start with, give us an idea of what your role is as the leader and how that leadership supports the Department of Homeland Security overall.
So I'm the head of the agency, and particularly when you're dealing with a young agency, which ICE is, my primary responsibility is to set the vision and policy for the agency, to have a clear sense of how we're going to use the resources that Congress gives us, and to help bring about a sort of lasting identity for an agency that was created from two different agencies that had very different responsibilities and proud histories of their own. When you're dealing with an agency as large as ICE, people think, of course, that you're involved in the day-to-day decision-making and the operations of the agency. In fact, that's not how these things work. When you're the head of the agency, there's very little in the way of individual cases or operations that you directly oversee, but rather you're trying to set the overall tone, tenor, and direction of the agency and make sure that whatever reforms are being brought in either by yourself or the broader administration are carried out and implemented.
So with such a critical mission, John, what are your three top management challenges, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
I'd say the top three challenges were and have been creating a unified identity for ICE when the agency was a marriage, and some would say a shotgun wedding, of two proud agencies with a very distinct history. So that's been item number one, building that new sense of purpose and identity as a collective. A second challenge has been to focus our immigration enforcement efforts in a way that makes sense when the agency, during its entire existence and the existence of the INS before it, has always been called on Congress to do more than its resources allow. And that's not anything new. That has been true in the immigration enforcement business for quite some time. And what I have tried to do is to say, we can't do everything that we are asked to do with the resources that we are provided. And so how do you do the best you can with what you have? What makes the most sense for the country? What things are we going to do well? What things are we going to focus on? And what things are, by definition, are we not going to focus on as much? So that has been a big effort, and it's an ongoing one. And then I'd say the third big challenge has been to ensure that the other part of what ICE does, which is investigate crimes, gets its due. Immigration tends to dominate the public perception of ICE, even though its criminal investigative responsibilities comprise over half the agency. In fact, we have more special agents than we do immigration officers.
So, John, what's the characteristic of an effective leader, given your background?
Well, I tell you, I have sort of watched leaders now for 20 years within the government, and I see two basic styles. I see some people who lead through a sense of intimidation and fear, and let's just say they may be more inclined to yelling and screaming. And then there are other leaders who I think try to lead by example and are firm. They're not pushovers, but they're fair and they're sort of understanding. And of course, I try to be that latter leader. I want people to follow me into the trenches because they believe in the cause and what I'm doing, rather than out of a fear that they're going to get shot if they don't. And so I try to motivate people. I want them to do a good job because they believe in doing a good job. I want them to feel that the work that they're about is important work, and they get up every day and think, you know what, I'm doing my part to advance a greater cause, and I'm not simply just showing up to earn a paycheck. And fortunately, for those of us who've been around a bit, I think one other important quality of a good leader is, you know, you got to be able to admit that you've made mistakes in life and you've learned from those mistakes. And, you know, anybody who's in a position of leadership who tells you they've never made a mistake, one isn't telling the truth. And then I think an effective leader is one who is prepared to make decisions, knows that Every once in a while, you won't get it exactly right, but you're going to, if you don't get it exactly right, you're going to admit it and you're going to fix it and you're going to move on and you're going to make a whole lot more good decisions than you make bad decisions.
What is ICE's strategic vision? We will ask John Morton, Director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is John Morton, Director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. So, John, you mentioned ICE's two-pronged mission, an investigative arm and an enforcement arm. I'd like to talk a little bit more about your vision, your strategic vision for the agency, and more particularly, how do the investigative and law enforcement arms or missions complement each other?
So the main area of overlap is that the investigative arm has a responsibility for immigration enforcement from a criminal perspective, from a criminal investigative perspective, and from a national security perspective. We're a big part of the joint terrorism task forces around the country. So we work very, very closely with the FBI on national security investigations, and that investigating immigration crimes and investigating national security crimes turns on, in many instances, immigration enforcement against people who are either here unlawfully or are born in a foreign country and aren't United States citizens. And so that's where enforcement and removal operations, which is our underlying enforcement arm on the immigration side, there's a lot of overlap there. As well, both ERO and Homeland Security Investigations, or HSI, they share the same basic goal of public safety. And one of the things that I have tried to do during my time as the leader of ICE is to instill that sense in Enforcement and Removal Operations, or ERO, that is a law enforcement agency and its primary purpose is one of public safety, in addition to the integrity of the immigration system. So we spent a lot of time focusing on trying to identify and remove criminal offenders with the aim of keeping our community safe. Obviously, Homeland Security Investigations comes at the same thing from a slightly different perspective, which is catching crooks and putting them in jail for the crimes that they have committed. And ERO is trying to catch crooks and remove them from the country if they're not here lawfully. I think we've done an awfully good job of focusing the agency on a public safety mission. And I think at the end of the day, when the history of ICE and its efforts are written, we will look back on the dramatic increase in the number of criminal offenders that we were not only investigating and prosecuting, but removing from the country with a great sense of accomplishment. And we're going to be able to link it to a fairly dramatic improvement in public safety in the major communities that ICE was operating in. And we're just now going about the statistical studies needed to demonstrate that link conclusively. There's lots of very good anecdotal evidence that that's what's happening, but I want to be able to do more and to really point to hard statistical analysis to say, you know what? When ICE shows up in your town, the number of gang members goes down, the number of serious crimes goes down, the number of criminal offenders walking the streets goes down. We're good for public safety. We're good for the health and well-being of the community that you live in. You need ICE, and we're a good thing when we show up.
Let me ask another aspect about keeping communities safe, and that's the prevention piece. So you talked about the prosecution and the removal, but you play an important role in keeping terrorists out of communities. So can you talk a little bit about how you do that and to the extent that technology plays any role in that prevention?
So this is you know, frankly, the most important responsibility that the Department of Homeland Security has and ICE has, which is to prevent an attack on the United States from terrorist or other nefarious influences. We tackle that goal at ICE in coordination with some very important partners, namely the FBI, the intelligence community, and Customs and Border Protection. Technology, as you note, has really helped change the game and has brought about some very exciting improvements in our ability to detect and prevent the entry of terrorists before they get here. It's an ever-changing world. The bad guys are always trying to stay a step ahead of us, and we're always trying to stay a step ahead of them, and the stakes are high. But we spend a lot of time now vetting applicants for visas, for example, vetting people who arrive and want to come to the United States from a security perspective. We work very closely with our other partners to ensure that people who want to do us harm are identified and kept away from our shores. And at the same time, of course, we want to promote as much lawful trade and travel as we can. We want people to come to Disney World, right? We want people to visit, you know, the Smithsonian. In fact, we want more people to come and visit the Smithsonian. It's a good thing for the United States, and we want more trade and travel. We want people to come to our universities from around the world. We just want to make sure that that flow is a lawful flow, and it's not one that people who would do us harm can hide within and exploit the great generosity that our country has shown foreigners for, you know, decades upon decades. So it's a balance. But a lot of phenomenal work has been done in this area. Most of it will never be fully told, but ICE plays a big role in that. I'm very proud of the efforts that we have undertaken, the extremely good and close working relationship that we have with FBI and CBP. TSA has a big role in this area, and I don't want to say that there isn't always room for improvement. There is, but the amount of coordination, the shared vetting that is going on is impressive.
John, I want to talk about the Southwest border security area, and in particular, the initiative that was sparked in 2009, I believe, is the Southwest Border Initiative. What's going on with your enforcement efforts in that area? And perhaps you could highlight some of the accomplishments and main challenges.
As you know, this has been an area of particular focus for the secretary. She came from the border. She was a border governor in Arizona. She was a United States attorney, so she understood the challenges along the border very, very well. And from the moment she arrived, she set about improving border security in a meaningful but thoughtful way, right? She was very focused on practical results, making the border more secure while at the same time promoting lawful trade and travel and having, you know, vibrant exchange. ICE has played a big part of that effort. People tend to think of CBP as the primary border enforcement agency, and CBP is largely based along the border, although they're at all of the nation's international airports. People don't realize how much of a border security function ICE carries out. About a third of our officers and agents are, in fact, stationed on the border. A huge number of our criminal investigations are focused on border crimes and transnational criminal networks. And while I have been the head of ICE, we've also started to devote a lot of our immigration enforcement resources, which heretofore were largely focused in the interior, to put more of those resources on border enforcement efforts. And so you have seen a much closer relationship between CBP and ICE along the border. We're CBP's investigative arm. CBP does not have investigative authority. That is ICE's authority. And so we work very, very closely there. And we are the detention and administrative prosecution power on the immigration side as well. CBP's done a tremendous job along the border, and apprehensions are at an all-time low. Part of that is obviously an effect of the economic state of the country the last few years, but an important part of it is CBP's improved efforts along the border. They've gotten quite sophisticated at analyzing flows, at deploying resources in a way that makes the illicit flow of contraband and people a lot harder. And then ICE has joined by bringing its robust powers of detention and prosecution to bear. So it's an exciting time. There's more work to be done.
I want to ask you a little bit. I think there's lots of people that have heard the term secure communities, but probably don't really understand what it means, both for the Homeland Protection and really in accomplishing your mission. So can you tell us a little bit about secure communities?
I sure can. I'm a very strong proponent of secure communities. You're right. It is poorly understood. That is partly a response, partly the fault of the agencies in doing a poor job in the initial years of explaining the program and what its purpose was. It's partly the result of some intentional distortion by people who don't support the program. But it got started in 2008. Congress actually chartered the program. Congress directed the agency to prioritize its enforcement efforts on criminal offenders, directed the agency to identify, for purposes of removal, every single person who is in the nation's criminal justice system and had been convicted of a crime. Absolutely the right idea. It made absolute sense for Congress to do that. In a world of limited resources, where should we focus immigration enforcement efforts? Well, a good place to start is jails, the nation's prisons and jails, people who are here not only unlawfully, but at the same time they're committing crimes. So that's how Secure Communities was born. And what the agency's response to Congress's direction was to use the fingerprints that are submitted to the FBI by the nation's prisons and jails to identify people who are here unlawfully. So when people are booked for a criminal arrest, their fingerprints are sent by the arresting jurisdiction to the FBI. And the FBI, by statute, shares that information with the Department of Homeland Security. And we use that fingerprint information to identify people who not only been charged with a crime, but are here unlawfully. And then we make a determination as to whether or not we are going to seek to remove that person from the country. Only people who've been arrested for a crime have their fingerprints run. And it's not up to the local jurisdiction as to whose fingerprints are run. Everybody's fingerprint is run. And then the only question is the identification of the individual such that it warrants immigration enforcement activity? To me, there is no arguing with the legitimate government interest in identifying those offenders and removing them from the country. Because when we do that, guess what? The rate of recidivism for that class of offenders, assuming they don't reenter the country, goes to zero. And that's why, as I mentioned earlier, I am convinced we are having a very, very profound effect on public safety in the communities in which we're operating these enforcement programs. And we have gone from the very first implementation of secure communities in Harris County, Texas in 2008 to now secure communities is live in every single state of the union. And we only have a few jurisdictions left in Alabama and Illinois before we will be in every single jurisdiction in the United States, well over 3,000. Wow. It's not without its challenges and controversies. For starters, the agency, as I said earlier, particularly back in 08 and 09, was not always clear about what the program was. And so we've taken the approach this past year of trying to prioritize our efforts within secure communities on offenses that everyone agrees are serious, and we only initiate enforcement for minor traffic offenses upon conviction. We don't start the process upon arrest in most instances. You know, my view is we just can't have a rule that says it's okay to come to the United States unlawfully and it's okay to commit crimes as long as they're not, you know, felonies. It's okay to commit misdemeanors. Well, that can't be the rule. That can't be good policy.
Well, John, actually, that's a wonderful concrete explanation of secure communities. I was wondering, how does it differ from the old 287G program? And are you reducing the use of task force agreements in the 287G program?
So there's a lot of difference between secure communities and 287G. Secure communities is an information sharing program that allows us to identify people based on their fingerprints in the nation's jails and prisons. The 287G agreements are agreements that arise from a provision in the Immigration and Nationality Act, Section 287G. So right there, people often think that 287G is a creation of the agency. It's not. It's federal law. What 287G allows is for the agency to delegate federal enforcement powers to state law enforcement. And we've done that in about 70 cases. So for starters, your listeners need to understand that 287G is a very limited program, has always been a very limited program, whereas secure communities is, as I said, now essentially in every single jurisdiction of the country, and there are over 3,000 of those. But 287G involves a delegation of our authority so that state law enforcement officers can identify and begin the removal process against people who are here unlawfully. The agency, by design, has always limited that delegation, and any removal has to have ICE's final approval to go forward. And there are two basic models. One is 287G in jails, where we delegate our authority, usually to deputy sheriffs, to help us with the identification and processing and handling of criminal offenders in a jail setting. And I think 287G actually works quite well in that setting. And then there's what is known as the task force model, where we delegated immigration enforcement authority to law enforcement officers, say detectives or state troopers, who weren't working in a jail setting but were rather working on the street. And there, the authority has been much more controversial and has been part of the broader national debate on the extent to which state and local authorities should be involved in immigration enforcement at all. And it has also proved not to be terribly productive. So at the end of the day, I've largely approached this question in terms of, is it a good use of our resources? Is it leading to enforcement that makes sense for the country? And when it comes to 287G in the jails, the answer is largely yes. And when it comes to the task forces, quite often the answer is no. And it's no for a very simple reason, that in these difficult economic times, we have delegated authorities to task force officers that have largely gone unused. And so we have a number of task forces that exist where we have given 287G authority, but in practice there have been no removals whatsoever for several years running. Not because there was any philosophical issue. It was the law enforcement agency in question became strapped for resources. And, the first thing that went was, you know, immigration enforcement efforts on behalf of the federal government. And they focused quite naturally on their core mission, which was local law enforcement.
Well, there's another area I wanted to touch on quickly, and it's the other aspect of your enforcement mission, and that is worksite enforcement. Could you give us a sense of your strategy? And particularly, how does the ICE Mutual Agreement Between Government Employees Program, IMAGE, and E-Verify factor into this effort?
So on worksite enforcement, we came into office and the secretary and I sat down and thought, how can we go about this effort in a way that really encourages employers to follow the law, when the amount of resources that the agency has to devote to that effort is very small when you consider the 6 to 7 million employers out there? And at its inception, the agency had focused on a lot of very high-profile worksite enforcement actions against large employers, and the focus was often on identifying and removing the employees who were there unlawfully. In my view, the long-term success of the worksite enforcement program has to start first and foremost with employers. We have to create a culture of compliance within America's businesses. And you do that two ways. you have a carrot and you have a stick. The carrot is image, in which we reach our hand out to the vast majority of U.S. employers who want to comply with the law, and in fact are taking great steps to comply with the law. And we help them, and we enter into a partnership, which is what image is all about, in which we say, listen, if you pursue these best practices, take these steps, and put into place basic assurances that we believe in that are going to lead to a lawful workforce, we're going to work with you, and we're going to agree that we're not going to show up at your front door with a bunch of special agents or conduct I-9 audit after I-9 audit, because we know you have the procedures in place. We know that we can come and verify them, and we've got bigger fish to fry because there are plenty of other people out there who aren't taking the steps that you are. And so Image tries to recognize the efforts of those companies who want to do the right thing and want to comply with the law, and we provide them the expertise and comfort that they're not going to get burned in trying to do it. On the other hand, there is a small but significant class of employers that are not following the rules, are trying to use the failure to follow the law to a competitive advantage. And well, there it's the stick. And there it's got to be that the government is going to enforce the law. And there's going to be a real question in the back of your mind if you're an employer who's inclined to be unscrupulous about whether or not we're going to show up. And so we've dramatically increased the number of I-9 audits. We do them, and for your listeners, the I-9 form is the form that everyone in the United States has to fill out when they take on a new job to demonstrate that they're authorized to work in the United States. And it applies to all employers, and it applies to all employees. And if citizen, non-citizen, we all have to demonstrate that we have the authority to work in the United States. E-Verify is a critical part of these efforts, particularly Image. In my view, if the federal government is going to impose a responsibility on every single employer to verify the work authorization of every single employee, well, then it's incumbent on us to make that process as easy as possible, right? And that's where E-Verify comes in. It's administered by our sister agency, Citizenship and Immigration Services. It, I think, has proven to be a very, very effective means of verification. Its opponents in the past have distorted its accuracy. And, in fact, it's proven to be very, very accurate, particularly with regard to identifying whether or not somebody has legitimate work authorization. Like any program, it can be susceptible to intentional fraud. But it's very good at identifying those people who have work authorization and want to be known as having work authorization. It makes the error rate is small there. I think it's another one of the reforms that is going to be lasting.
How is ICE pursuing innovative enforcement strategies? We will ask John Morton, director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is John Morton, Director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. So, John, I'd like to discuss your efforts to reform the immigration detention system. Could you outline your strategy? How do you do it in an era of fiscal austerity?
I recognize that the power of detention is an awesome power of the sovereign and is one that needs to be exercised. The immigration enforcement system depends on it. There's a high correlation between detention and removal, very high. The reason you need to detain them is that they'll run away if you don't. And so we detain people of all ages, both genders, all sorts of circumstances. And my view is that if we're going to exercise that power and exercise it on a grand scale, which we do, we've never had more detention space than we do right now. We were averaging just 2 weeks ago 37,000 beds a day. That's a lot of detention beds. We're going to detain something on the order of 400,000 people this year. If we're going to operate that kind of a system, it is incumbent on us to make sure that we detain these people in settings that are appropriate and that we provide good custodial care, good medical care. And I think that is our obligation regardless of the person's circumstance, you know, even if the person is a criminal. If we're going to detain them, we need to make sure that we at least provide them with good medical care and that while they're in our custody and on their way out of the country, they're well treated. So what has that meant in practice? It's meant a series of reforms that have been many years in the making. We have instituted an online detainee locator system. So for the first time in the agency's history, you can type in somebody's name, and if we're detaining them, it'll tell you where they're being detained, how to get there, how to contact them, what the number is, what the visiting hours are. Huge reform. We have medical specialists now in our major facilities. We've completely overhauled the medical care we provide. We've expanded it dramatically. We've instituted a whole series of improved medical standards. We've created a advisory group with immigration advocates and medical professionals to advise us on how to do this. And at the same time, we've gone out and when we contract now for detention space or assistance, we work this into the contract. And we've been able to pay for it because we've been a much more discriminating customer when it comes to detention space.
John, as you predicted at the top of the show, our discussion so far has all been about people and immigration. I want to take a minute to get you to talk a little bit about the threat posed by either goods coming in or goods going out. And one that I'd like you to highlight is the role on, you know, sensitive technology, sensitive products. I think lots of listeners may not realize you have any role in protecting us from weapons of mass destruction or other devious intentions.
So ICE is the principal enforcer of the nation's export control laws. We run a center called the Export Enforcement Coordination Center. And what we do is to investigate unscrupulous arms dealers who are trying to obtain either sophisticated weaponry or sensitive technology in violation of the many U.S. laws, either restrict the export or prohibit it or require certain steps to be taken before the export can happen. Sadly, there is a thriving business in sensitive U.S. technology and sensitive weaponry. So we have to spend a lot of time on this. And our nation's national security depends on a very aggressive enforcement regime. It's a difficult regime because it's a game of cat and mouse. It's a game that is largely transnational. Many of the arms dealers and brokers are operating in foreign countries. So it's one of the reasons we have a very large international presence, because we need those relationships and that international presence to be able to carry out these investigations. And they take many, many years, and they take require a great deal of sophisticated investigation. I got to say, it's one of the areas of what ICE and in particular HSI does that I really am personally very proud of. And I think most citizens, if they knew the full story of what went into this kind of work, they'd be very proud of the work that our folks do on behalf of the country. I feel the same about a related area, which is intellectual property enforcement. We are the principal enforcers of the nation's intellectual property laws. You know, the United States is a country of innovation, and we produce many, many things and export many, many things because we are great thinkers and dreamers. And that part of our culture, that part of our business community, is an important reason why we are the world's great economic power. You've got to be able to protect that innovation or, you know, criminals are going to eat it alive. This is a problem that covers the entire spectrum of U.S. manufacturing and production. People try to, particularly the opponents of intellectual property enforcement, try to distort this argument into, you know, it's just, well, who cares if some 15-year-old, you know, downloads, you know, a song off the internet. No, this is about counterfeit airbags, counterfeit toothpaste, beauty products that you put on your face, engine parts, you know, engine spinning out the window there at 30,000 feet when you're crossing the Atlantic. This is not a minor concern. And it's also one that is really all about our economy. Guess what? Organized criminals, and this is what this game is now all about. It's organized crime. This isn't an individual mom-and-pop's operation. Organized criminals aren't paying pensions. They're not paying any taxes. They're not doing any R&D. They're not trying to make America great. They're just trying to make money by stealing someone else's hard work, paying some employee in the back room, you know, a third of what a legitimate employee would be paid, and then just waiting for the next advance, and then they're going to steal that as well.
Well, John, you actually mentioned public safety, as you pointed out, as a core, and you just described that very well. But it's another element of your mission that I don't think folks are really familiar with, and that is targeting and combating human trafficking and transnational sexual exploitation. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure can. So that's another area where ICE has really become the principal enforcers of federal law. So we spend a great deal of time on human trafficking, and we spend a great deal of time on the exploitation of children. Sadly, there is so much of this work, particularly on the child exploitation side of things, that I could have every agent in the agency doing this every day, and there'd be plenty of work. We're about to assume the chairmanship of the Virtual Global Task Force on Child Exploitation. Why that's important is because child exploitation, child pornography, has become increasingly international and it's become increasingly online. The internet has allowed for an explosion in the exchange of abusive material involving children. The internet makes that possible on a grand scale. Just to give you a little example of this, we just successfully brought down an international network of child pornographers, and they were producing a material and sharing it amongst themselves. And how we brought this network down is that we started out with a search warrant in Boston, and we came across a series of photographs of a 2-year-old boy who was being molested by an adult, and the boy was holding a stuffed animal in the series of pictures. We did not think the boy was American from the background of the photograph, and we turned to our friends at Interpol to help try to determine where this child was from. The Dutch National Police saw the photograph, and a very alert Dutch officer noticed that the stuffed animal was, in fact, a rabbit that was unique to Holland. And we then, working with the Dutch, arranged for one of the photographs to be shown on Dutch TV. And the night it was shown, the parents of the child recognized their child and called in and said, you know, that's my child, and I also know how this has unfolded because I think the person in question is going to be one of the men at the daycare that my child goes to. The individual, the perpetrator, was also watching the same show and began to try to destroy all of his records on his computer. Fortunately, we were able to move in quickly. The Dutch arrested him. But that kind of work, you just got to do it no matter what. It's the right thing to do. That doesn't really depend on resources. We're just going to do it and do it strongly. And then just try to get out there and educate people on the dangers that the internet can pose to very young children and how you got to keep an eye out on, you know, where your children are and who they're dealing with in those early formative years.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement? We will ask its director, John Morton, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is John Morton, Director of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. So, John, I often talk to my guests about the collaboration and partnership they have with other agencies and the private sector, but I'd like to focus on how ICE manages information sharing among agencies for intelligence and law enforcement.
Well, we've been helped by Congress that passed a number of statutory provisions right after 9/11 that encouraged the agencies to share more, right instinct, right call. And since that time, you have seen the agencies opening their databases to each other in a sort of much more coordinated and thoughtful way. So the Secure Communities Program, for example, is based on information sharing between FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department. The vetting that we now do for visa applicants is much more thoughtful and robust and is based on information sharing, again, between many, many agencies across the government. And it's allowed us to identify bad actors a lot more accurately and a lot earlier in the process. Now, I'll say it comes with a lot of challenges, and one of those is there's an enormous amount of information out there in those databases, and certain simply just linking them doesn't do you any good if you don't have a really good means of going through and having thoughtful searches with good algorithms looking for what is often a needle in a haystack. Fortunately, technology has progressed to the point that it is frankly quite amazing now how you can bring together a lot of disparate databases, sets of information, and with sophisticated algorithms, look for common patterns, common flags, common indicators that allow you to identify, say, 10 people who might be engaged in human trafficking in a way that a manual effort would never have been able to do, or that if you had relied on ICE's databases alone, you never would have seen that. A lot of work still to be done. It's a challenge just because, you know, listen, millions of people are traveling the globe every day. There's a lot to sort through, and you have to pay important attention to people's privacy.
So, John, I think our listeners will certainly conclude from this interview that there is ample work to be done within ICE. I thought it interesting when you said you could take all the agents and move them to just one activity and have plenty of work for them. If there's probably nothing else that's certain, though, as we look toward the future, the luxury of big budgets does not appear to be, at least in the the rest of our careers, I would think. So what work are you doing to really look at where additional efficiencies, where duplication can be eliminated, and where additional prioritization can be done?
So you're right. I don't think that in the near future any of the law enforcement agencies, any of the agencies in the federal government are looking at major budget increases. So that means we've got to tighten our belt wherever possible, and as you said, focus on prioritization. We've just got to be upfront about being asked to do more than our resources allow. And so within what our resources permit, focusing on those things that are going to bring the best result for the people of the United States and the communities in which we serve. So for ICE, I think you will see a continued effort to stay focused on sensible immigration enforcement priorities, criminals, recent border entrants, people who've been deported, come back again, people who've engaged in fraud. And does that mean that we're going to spend less time focused on somebody who's been here 15 years, has got 3 U.S. citizen children and 2 cars in the driveway and a clean record? Yes, that's right. That's what it means when each year you can remove maybe 400,000 people and there's a pool of between 11 and 14 million people that in theory you should remove. That there's no other answer than prioritization unless you're going to go with a model of, well, it's the first 400,000 people we come across. That could be the model. I just don't think it makes any sense. Well, I am going to start with a person with 2 felony convictions. That's just, that makes sense. I think it's going to mean looking to purchase services in a way more like businesses have heretofore, being, you know, thinking about yourself as a competitive, sophisticated consumer. And that's particularly true when you have parts of your budget that are high dollar. Sometimes the private sector can do things more efficiently than government. There are other times when doing things in-house with federal employees makes more sense, is more efficient, and leads to a lower cost for the taxpayer. And we've just got to constantly look at those things, constantly think about good management in the agency to save money. There's just no other way. We are not going to look at or see large increases in our budget for the next few years.
I guess a kind of a follow-up on that, and you know, I know it's impossible to know what the future is going to bring, but you know, having done this your entire career, what are the things that you are concerned about that will be problems in the future that you're going to have to roll into everything else that you've told us today that you do?
Attracting and maintaining a educated, motivated, sophisticated workforce, I think, is very important. I'm cognizant as a leader and manager of people how important people are to the underlying success of an organization. You've got to have good vision, you've got to have a good game plan, but at the end of the day, you've got to have good people. I also think a big challenge going forward, we have to prioritize, we have to have a thoughtful set of principles that drives the executive branch's actions. And that's going to be particularly pronounced when budgets continue to get reduced. And there just literally is going to be no way to do all of the things that we might have done in the past. And we're going to have some very difficult and honest conversations about what things we're going to do less of. And I also think, particular to ICE, we're going to have to come to a national consensus on immigration. It hasn't happened so far during my tenure, although I think slowly but surely there is a near universal recognition that we cannot continue on as we have in the past, that we have to come to some rational immigration reform. The devil's in the details, high passions on either side on how that's going to look, but everyone who is thoughtful on this subject agrees that the present system is not working, that the laws need reform, and we've got to change.
As we close this conversation today, I'd like to get your advice on 2 aspects. One is, how do you cultivate a culture of integrity within your agency? And more importantly, what advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in public service?
Well, let me start with the latter. If you're thinking about a career in public service, I would strongly encourage you to embrace it.